Hi, everybody.
Thanks
for the wave. My name's Jordan. I know some of you, but not all of you. This is my Christian Works, and I'm very happy to share it with you. And I'm delighted that Leslie and Katz and Kareem are here. We didn't have an opening for various reasons, including COVID. And travel to Alaska and travel to Maine. It couldn't have happened. It didn't happen. So I am really happy that you're all here and that the artists are here with us today. Just a little reminder about the format. I'm going to yap with Leslie for about 20, 25 minutes. And then Kareem will come up and speak with Katz. And then if he wants to come around and have a conversation, have a dialogue, then you're welcome to. If you want to get up and leave at any moment, it is a little toasty in here, I realize. It's an uncommonly warm day. Don't be shy. Do what you have to do. The setting is obviously somewhat informal. Guys, I think I'll introduce Katz and Kareem, I think, before I come around to Leslie. And do that. Katz Stepper is an artist based in Athens, Georgia, who in a past life made large-scale sculptural wall-based work, had a very winning show at White Columns in New York, and then I happened to see some of the work at a place called Atlanta Contemporary, and was really knocked out. I had wanted to show them some of these works in an exhibition in Chicago, but they proved too cumbersome to remove from storage and actually move. We reconnected through a great artist called Erin Jane Nelson, who's based in Atlanta, and until very recently was the executive director of a great digital portal called Burnaway, based in the South, about contemporary art in the American South. And one day, not all that long ago, Katz sent me a link to a video called Roasted Cockroach for Sale. And I was very immediately blown away. The work contains countless paradoxes, and one reason for its improbable success is that it's able to hold many paradoxes at the same time. It is somehow both literal, abstract, personal, familial, bodily, political, sociological, emotional, first person, shared person, epistolary, scripted, improvisational, tender, gross, banal, and revelatory. So we transformed the gallery just behind this wall into a video installation where that video has been playing for the last month and a half. And there is a link to the video on YouTube, and Katz is very pro viewing at your convenience and on your own time. So we welcome Katz Stepper. And my friend Kareem Fitzpatrick is here from Inverness, California, where she's a gifted writer, editor, and poet, and educator. Kareem's interested in the entanglements of capital, sickness, and wellness, as well as, more broadly, the idiosyncrasies of lived and shared experience. Kareem recently co-edited something called Risk Pool, which was an issue, a very kaleidoscopic investigation, sort of an issue, sponsored by and hosted by a group called Triple Canopy, based out of New York. The issue, in their own words, was especially interested in how the vulnerability of our bodies and the illnesses that occasionally or continually seize them reveal structural aspects of our society. It's totally amazing. The list of contributors is mind-boggling. And Katz and Kareem have an awful lot in common, so I'm very grateful that Kareem is able to join us from Inverness with her whole family today. Thanks for being here, Kareem. Okay, so this room was actually Leslie's studio. I don't know how many of you know that. This was Leslie's studio for many years. Leslie lived in San Francisco for a long time, went to SFAI, and then graduate school at CCA. I've known and been friendly with Leslie for a long time, and I've wanted to do an exhibition of Leslie's work for as long as I've had the space. Leslie moved to Los Angeles several years ago, and although we don't live in the same city anymore, I've learned an awful lot from Leslie, not just about being an artist, but about the natural world, emotional worlds, intuition, independence, and how one might foment a politic where you might not expect it. I've been having conversations with Leslie about not just this work, which is all brand new, but about the development of Leslie's work for the last many number of years. And because we don't really have that long to talk today, I wanted to do something that was a little funny, just like not actually start at the ground floor, but start sort of a few levels up. And although it might sound sort of a little bit preposterous, and we can certainly chat more about other things later, I wanted to ask Leslie, out of the gate, and it's not totally out of nowhere because, again, it's this evolving generative dialogue, but what can painting do, Leslie?
I'm going to remove my mask while I talk. That's okay?
Yeah, I think it's just fine.
It's a question I ask myself a lot. I used to have it written on the wall right there. And I guess I would think about, like, what can painting do? I can talk about what painting has done for me, which is, like, I'm doing this experiment lately where I'm used to, as a lot of us are, like, seeing the natural world as, like, an it, usually, and I'm like, well, what if I try to remember to see it as a you, and maybe even address it sometimes as a you, or, like, a multitude of yous, and it's kind of like, I call it a speculative animism. And I think, like, for me, making these paintings is a way of thinking through, like, all the different kinds of questions about that, and, like, lenses through which to see the natural world. And I had this experience where I was at the Glendale Galleria Mall in LA a few weeks ago, and I saw, like, all these, like, Hermes bags and, like, the perfume and, like, the brass, and I really felt, I didn't just think about it in a way where I would, like, tweet about it. I, like, felt the extractiveness of it. Like, I felt this feeling that it had, like, been pulled out of the ground. And it was here, like, perfumed. And then there's this cycle of desire. And then it would be waste at a certain point. And I wasn't, like, in any way moralizing. I was just feeling it. And I was like, I think that my thinking through this has, like, it's integrated into my body now. And I felt like that was, like, a success. That's, like, maybe what my painting can do for me. But I think there's also, like, a wish that you could make visual objects that could address the visual sensory perception. So, like, thinking about art not only as an object, but as, like, a perceptual experience that happens, like, with a person's body or their perceptual apparatus, which has evolved over so much time to perceive nuances that are, like, really vast, like, colors and textures and sounds that are really, like, multi-leveled. And, you know, there's this idea that our manufactured world our world that we kind of go around in is like quite like a narrow range of perceptual experiences in a way, even though we have this capacity for like a lot more than that. So maybe I feel like for me, I would like to address and meet the perceiver and address those perceptual capacities in a way that's kind of analogous to ways of addressing and meeting the natural world, or just the world, I guess.
There's obviously a history in art of landscape painting. A lot of the work that you have been doing for the last 20 years is sort of landscape adjacent, and I know you don't refer to them necessarily as landscapes, but I do know you're from Alaska. I know you grew up walking your dog by the glacier. I want to know how you think about landscape and how you think about especially the history of Western-based landscape vis-a-vis the notion of embodiment and or surveying and how to situate oneself in the landscape, how it's represented, and how you think through that in a practice that so values the primacy of the viewer's experience rather than your perspective in making it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the like the very short answer about Western landscape painting is it's often a view, a lens or a view that's like, here's the domain, like here's the vista, and there's a sense of, it's just a particular kind of lens that has like a lot of implications. And I think maybe like an alternative to that is a feeling of being inside something or like very up close to, very up close inside a landscape in a way that is like the boundaries are more eroded. And also that the intimacy can like open up other ways of experiencing it that are like, I'm just gonna give an example of like, I have this memory of sitting underneath like blueberry bushes when I was a kid, like sucking the sugar water out of the blueberry blossoms. like that pink form really has a blueberry blossom kind of form to it. So that's like something I kind of pulled. I mean, there are a lot of different layers happening in these, but I just thought I would throw it out there as like an example of really being in, like that's a different way of experiencing the landscape than, you know, standing on the mountain looking at, which I also really like to do.
But. I mean, that makes me think, you've told me about your desire to not necessarily paint the thunderstorm, but to conjure the thunderstorm, or to afford the viewer the feeling of potentially being surrounded by thunderstorm. The question of representation is interesting in these works, is there are certain things you can point to and make connections with, but how did you negotiate that in this body of work that's abstract but is not sort of in the realm of pure abstract painting?
I feel like I could go, I mean, there's like different ways of thinking about representation, and I do think like the way nature is represented matters, and I feel really critical of things like nature shows that, you know, even though they're beautiful, like there's such a frame, and so I just think about different like alternative ways. So yeah, I would not, you know, like this one. Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think about like how to pull a particular feeling through the work and like hit the person, and that it's and that things are happening on multiple octaves at once,
right.
and it's not so easy to make a closure of like, what is this that I'm looking at? Is it a space? Is this a flower? Is this an abstract composition that's about to collapse? So I think like the multiple layers of unclosed loops, both like materially, like what is this made of, what material is this, and what is it suggesting? Those kinds of experiences of like, I'm not quite sure what I'm looking at, like there's an openness to that and an electricity to it that I value both when I look at art and I kind of aspire to as a way of like being in relationship to the world and especially the non-human world.
Right. I wonder if you could tell the folks here about this fellow Cyril Stanley Smith you were telling about.
So a really influential person for me for a long time has been this metallurgist Cyril Stanley Smith, who wrote a couple of books. So he was a metallurgist, but he was really became really interested in art history, and he has written so beautifully about, like, looking, since he's a metallurgist, he understands the deep structure of materials and especially metals, so he can look at these, like, really old artworks, like cast bronzes, and he's written about like this thing that he recognized in artisans and craftspeople, people who work with materials, where the way that they work with it is like love. It's something like this care or attention where, even though at the time they didn't know the deep structure of metal, a microscope had not been invented, but they felt into it and they felt what the material could do. And like many times over, many people over many generations over, and those kinds of like feeling into the material world has brought us everything that we have in like materially in civilization. Like those are how discoveries were made, and that it's, you know, it's compatible with a kind of a scientific way of thinking, that it's like this care and attention in whatever way. So I thought that was I really love the way he writes about that, and it influenced my thinking
quite it a bit. Scrambles ideas about what content is, especially at this moment in contemporary art.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that it makes me think is a lot of artists have come in to see the show, and they have a very like a 5-inch up close relationship with the work, and want to know what it is and how it's made and is that sound, and then a lot of curators come into the show and stand 15 feet back and say, is it a painting or a sculpture? I wonder how Cyril Stanley Smith's perspective engages with those, not to like establish this binary and then destroy it, but that's fine, I guess. But how can we factor that into those perspectives, and what does that do to notions of categorical thinking? Or is like categorical thinking ever helpful for you? Is it just something that you're explicitly trying to explode?
I mean, definitely the experience of a perception of knowing what something is like the, it's a really big part of the contraption I feel like I'm building. And I don't know, should we talk about language a little bit? I guess like, I will say that I think that like for every artist who works in abstraction, there's an abstraction. It's like every artist has their own, every artist working in abstraction has their own abstraction. And for me, like my abstraction is really adjacent to language. I feel like it pings areas of the brain that are very close to language. There's a lot of sharpness of detail and like recognizable, there's like almost like a like sequential things, or like I love scroll paintings where you're like looking at like a static image that feels like it might be like moving through time. So there's like a sense of reading, there's like an articulateness with like the detail, but at the same time, again, it's like that ability to thwart the ways that language likes to like overdetermine things. And so I wonder if people would, like if a person might see a different type of abstraction and wonder whether it was a painting or a sculpture in the same way. I don't know. I'm purposefully not, I'm not answering you directly because that is my way. But,
Well, that's what the works, that's what the works do. And we've talked about how the works conjure their own sort of language. They don't necessarily, they're not necessarily anti-language or attempt to thwart language, but if you think of poetry as, it has something more to do with the construction of idiosyncratic ways of constructing meaning, maybe.
Yeah, and I think about, it's again, it's the question of what can painting do that nothing else can do? What can painting do that language can't do, that sculpture can't do, that film can't do? And there's a lot of things, and that sort of field of play and inquiry has always been really exciting to me. So, like, the staticness plus and a sense of time. Like the sense of time that you can get in a static painting is so different than in a, especially if it looks handmade. I heard this thing, I don't know if it's true or not, but someone told me once that if when you look at a handmade, specifically handmade object, it like fires your mirror neurons as if you had made it. I don't know if that's true or not, but we have fact check. I would like it to be true, but I always thought that was interesting, if true. Crazy if true.
All right, well, before we invite Karina up here, I wonder if we could invite time into the conversation in a more explicit way, because these do seem to have a relationship with a sense of deep time or mineralogical time, layered kinds of time. How do I want to approach this? In the work that you were making when we first met, a lot of it was rectangular or horizontal or square. It was you could think of it like a photographic frame, maybe, or a film frame or something. And now, obviously, we're in another place here.
Yeah.
How does your thinking about time or these works engage or not with the notion of the way that we might read artworks, I don't know, left to right or top to bottom, or think about what sort of time can be contained in a still image when you're not really even making a still image anymore? It's a self-contained constellation.
Yeah. Well, you never escape the rectangle. It's just the rectangle just becomes the wall. I mean, they're related to the rectangle, but it's an extension. I'll just say it's just a natural extension of a collage and assemblage process, like cutting into the rectangle at a certain point. I was like, if I'm cutting shapes, why am I not just committing to cutting shapes and thinking? I mean, I love thinking about like the whole show at once, and so I'm just engaging with the rectangle and the Lord. Anyway, it's a can of worms, but I was like, I have to do it. But in terms of time, I guess all I'll say about time, and it's not really answering your question, but I've been thinking. I always think a lot about deep time, like with going to the glacier as a kid and learning about that concept of deep time. But also, like lately with these works, this is a new thing. I was thinking about like deep time and then civilization, the time scale of civilizations, the time scale of a single gesture, and kind of nesting those, which I've been doing for many years. But there is in this particular show. Just this particular show, I was looking at like Assyrian and Egyptian reliefs, I don't want to reveal too much about some of my, my pool of imagery, because that's not where the meaning lies for me.
Yeah.
The meaning lies in many different places aside from the imagery, but thinking about like. Looking at this kind of time scale of in this time that we're in now, what is the relationship between like my experience and like someone who made an Assyrian relief? Is there any relation? And so I sometimes I get a feeling. Sometimes I get a feeling of like. What it could have been like, obviously it's like just, it's my imagination, but I'm like, I don't know how else to describe it. And I'm like, can I get that into a painting? I don't know. I mean, it'll translate as something else to the person, but this is like the impossible, this is like my, like reaching for stars, I guess.
Perfect.
Is that the end?
Someone's right on time. That's perfect. That's amazing. So let's, well, transition, and then we'll have a little dialogue. Thanks, Leslie. Well, my career. Shake it off. Feel free to stretch.
We might get a 3-foot tall visitor.
All pitchers welcome.
Only a little bit shorter than me.
thanks for that. I just wrote down something that you said that I felt like was connecting to where I wanted to maybe start, and now we'll start. First of all, it's congrats on the show, guys. It's Leslie, you were just saying about one aspect of your paintings might be trying to thwart the way that language tries to overdetermine things. And Katz and I spoke 2 days ago for a while just to kind of wrangle all the many things to try to cram into 25 minutes. And I was really struck by something you said about how you approached this film as an object maker, and the material was the language, and not even the interface of the language, not necessarily just the Google Doc and the Zoom and the speech transcription, but just the language itself and the conversation and the scripts. And you said something else that really struck me about how you're a maximalist, and you're a maximalist in your sculptural visual work, in your studio practice, and then even though I'm, in some ways, these 47 minutes in that room seem very, on the surface, they could seem sparse because there's no footage or no picture, it's really, I have COVID brain totally from weeks ago, so if I just lose a word, I do not have maximal language right now. There's just this effluence of language and speech, and I've watched it 3 times. Like, I can't possibly, I'm trying to read all the parts that you're not transcribing, and there's a certain activation in that excess. Mm-hmm. And this all leads me to my first question, which is, we had also discussed how Katz seems to be really asserting we could call it a poetics or an aesthetics or a sensibility of disability and of illness, and then also of diaspora, which is kind of the point of the film, and how it just seems really full-throated in Roasted Cockroach for scale. And so I just wanted to ask you about different formal aspects of the film. And I just want to note that in an interview Katz did with Greg Wardowitz, they really held on to calling it a film as opposed to a video piece, because there's a beginning and an end. And I think that's an example of one of the formal decisions or way of talking about it. And different things we had talked about on Zoom were, the redaction of footage and of certain language, certainly, but the idea of prostheses or the idea of translation and all of these different decisions you made in the editing and capturing process that assert your particular style, which again, I'm trying to pose a question, but just I love that idea.
Okay, sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's great, thanks. Yeah, thanks everyone for being here. I think maybe to return to the idea of maximalism and why I guess I orient around excess in relation to disability, or maybe how that feels a little different than some of the artists that I learned a lot from, but who are thinking about disability in relation to minimalism and like the ready-made. For me, excess is like, first of all, in some ways, how illness can present itself, like a body overproducing or, like spilling, leaking, failing to comply to like a regulated idea of functionality. And, you know, the way that starts to show up in the video is that there's kind of a inseparability between life and the art piece. And I kind of think the whole thing functions as an experimental documentary, but like at one point, I have to run to the bathroom in the middle of the recording, and that becomes like a scene in the film as opposed to the excess, the peripheral that gets cut out and not shown. So it's a kind of insistence on like showing what you're not supposed to show. And you know, I think just the length of it, like it's a lot to read for 47 minutes in the context of watching a video. So there is a kind of overproduction of language, and language starts to scramble and layer within itself. And the language spawns like emails, translating a memoir from a grandmother, and that being like translated and transliterated and then processed through an AI speech to text transcription and then read back by us. So these various like almost over-processing of the language to get it to this point where it starts to become like literature, even though a lot of the language is being pulled from just life and living and talking and being in conversation. There is also scripting, but that's also kind of transmutated through processing in relation with my dad. And these interfaces that we are communicating through, because the whole video was conducted over Zoom, Google, and this AI transcription.
I like getting a peek behind the scenes of it. Also, I know you had said that the project of making this with your dad was about 9 to 10 months of communicating in this very intentional way with this artwork in mind. And I can only imagine how much was left on the proverbial cutting room floor, mm-hmm. 9 to 10 months worth of talking. And I think that to use a phrase that you used in our conversation the other day, like so much of the emotional charge of the work is just, well, the obvious father-adult-child bond and love that's so evident with you and your dad, but just all the layers of meaning and affection behind every joke or every, like, snarl, or just all of that stuff is really part of the material as well, even though that's harder to kind of say in a critical way, that's like if there was the material list, you're like, family conflict. I guess I'm interested in trying to grapple with these kind of, not abstract words, but like airy words as material, like remoteness, how remoteness is one of the materials of this piece. And you had said something, I think in the cuts, if I can share, that you wrote a wonderful essay about this film that even Jordan didn't know about until 3 days ago. So I don't know how public it is, but it's really well written and beautiful and seems like a companion to the film itself. I believe I'm quoting your essay and not film when you wrote remoteness as that which contains multiple locations at once. And I guess this does loop back to the maximalism. Like, instead of seeing remoteness as a lack or an absence or a dearth, you're seeing, like, it contains multitudes. And mm-hmm. You had said something, I think, in a conversation with Greg Bordowitz again about how illness has given you so much more than it's taken away. I mean, you can't imagine your life or your work without it. And so I just think that this insistence on, it's not really optimism, but just being generative with everything, whether it's the circumstances of the pandemic that we've all been living through, or your own personal circumstances, or even like a major fundamental political difference of opinions with your father, which is really not the subtext of this film, but you never say it head on, but it's obviously what the film is shaped around. I'm curious to know if, as you set out to make this, if you knew how much of the specific details, like, you in the film, for those of you who haven't seen it, certain countries are never named, or the word Holocaust is never used. All of the kind of flashpoints are either redacted quite literally with a bar over words, or just not mentioned. And how did you know you were going to hold back in that way from the get-go, or did that come through editing?
Yeah, I think I did play with obfuscation from the get-go for a lot of reasons. In one sense, I like wanted to present something that felt really close to my skin, really embodied, and not turned into capital letter words, because I'm much more interested in the micro experience and then how that ping pongs and ricochets with the macro. I also knew that to make a work that like investigated something about how Holocaust memory lives in like a family and in someone's cells in the year 2021, like, can accidentally risk feeding into a kind of established propaganda campaign for like settler colonialism in Palestine and the Zionist like political project. And I really needed, I mean, the work like really wants to resist that and challenge that while also looking at things that like have not or cannot possibly cannot be processed in just two generations, and are just, there's like these traces that can't that like maybe my body forces me to sit with, but I really appreciate this idea of like being generative, seeing everything as material versus even optimism. It's more for me about a non-hierarchical relation to like what is, and the pandemic as a kind of mass experience of illness felt very familiar to people that already live with illness and disability, and remoteness as a communication tool, like there's like specific kind of idea of remote communication through the digital was already a big part of my sociality. And it wasn't like, it was difficult, but that was one of the major emotional like challenges for people in the pandemic, because what was really challenging was that people were being forced to like go to work and be exposed to this virus when they didn't, like when there was, all this was, so much was preventable, but that we were given new ways to access being together was actually for me extremely generative and related to experiences of like immigration and diaspora, where not everyone has direct access to each other, or there's all these various conditions where arrival to face-to-face contact isn't possible. And I'm so interested in what is like multiplicitous in location, and also how that kind of has a temporal quality with like epigenetics, and how epigenetics is kind of remote. It's a way of like time traveling in a nonlinear way and arising in someone's body. I just was like very invested in an expanded definition of remoteness that sort of, and I think I'm still, you know, it's really like wonderful to be in gathering, but it's not better. It's just different. And that's sort of the place I like to work from, is that there isn't like an ideal, and that, because when there's an ideal, like disability is the problem, mm-hmm. and there's an ideal normative body, or ideal normative conditions for bodies to be in relation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that you're incredibly successful at creating, it's just like a wholeness within a 47-minute temporal frame. There's so much, I mean, content in there, but even just registers and textures and ways of feeling and ways of communicating that you all, it's very seamless. And I think it is a testament to your commitment to not having an ideal in any binary or any hierarchy. It seems so genuine in the work, and I think it's because it is so genuine. I don't know how we're doing on time, but...
A little bit longer.
There's so much I want to say and ask you. I'm sorry my questions aren't posed more question-like, but I want to talk about colonoscopies. You said at some point that the film is like a metaphorical colonoscopy, and then a colonoscopy is discussed in the film, and then you use formally in a Google Doc, you use a black kind of period expanded to obscure the script that you're having your father read. So there's just this large black void kind of moving across the screen, and your father is trying to read around it, and it becomes impossible. And it's both visually arresting and funny, and you're kind of just messing with your dad, and it's a way of not saying the capital letter words. I'm so sorry, my questions are all just one phrase,
Can talk about the black circle.
Black circle.
I do come from a like very visual practice, but really wanted like text, digital text in corporate interfaces specifically to be the main visual experience of the video. Within the Google Doc, I was like trying to find ways to make it visually engaging, and very crudely though, like it's super, like I just call it like stoner manipulations. Be like, I'm gonna take this shape and make the size really big, and then zoom in and, you know, make these very sort of crude ways that suddenly the Google Doc becomes a little bit more visually like charged and a little bit less familiar. And the black circle is both like a void and a positive shape. Like it's also non-binary in the ways that it, it's like a positive shape because it pushes words around. And again, that's all just like using the Google Doc to start to come up with kind of, I guess, concrete poetry in moving image form. And it's like one of the only things that isn't like letter-based language, but it is still punctuation, basically. But it also, like a circle is, you know, has an inherent relationship to like bodily things, orifices, cells. So it's like exciting from a kind of geometric abstraction position that it can kind of hold all of these ways that we might like find something in common with it or have a locate it in our bodies in different ways. And the colonoscopy, yeah, like the piece is this sort of deep inward looking, almost like to the point of being invasive. And like a colonoscopy is a remote experience. It's using like remote technology to image something that maybe we're like not totally meant to see. And then if you have had a lot of colonoscopies, like you kind of live in this interesting sci-fi new reality where like you do know what your own insides look like, and it's, you know, an experience that can like, it does bring the kind of medical industrial like gaze into your own consciousness, which, you know, I think I'm just really interested in how we're entangled with like corporate technology and these various industrial systems, and how do we kind of talk back to them through them as opposed to escaping them, because like we are contaminated and I'm very pro-contamination. Yeah.
Should we open it up?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, if anyone wants to contaminate the dialogue, the works are there's a real through line between, they're very similar, very different in sort of intense ways. I hadn't really thought about it before, but for those of you who've seen it on the other side of the video projector, it's like this black hole just kind of goes through the wall and glass. Back there, there's sort of a lot of leakage in a lot of, in the works, and stubbornness and sort of unpredictable politics. There's sort of a very different relationship with materiality, obviously, and if this show is sort of a love letter in a kind of way to working with the hands, Katz's work is much, much different, and has to do with a kind of, I don't know, reluctant engagement, maybe you might call it, and a pro-contamination of those kinds of materials. Anyway, so if anyone has any questions or things to say or wants to make comparisons or contradictions, you're welcome to.
Or we can just party.
Okay. I really loved the piece so much. I was thinking about, or wondering if you could talk about inheriting or offering language and contamination or whatever word you'll have, for how it changes as it's passed on or returned to earlier versions of itself. I'm thinking about etymology, and perhaps you could maybe pull that in there as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's a rich question, and I think like all of our language is inherited, right? And we are all like products of the language that we've been given. So, and like language shapes our consciousness. So there's I don't know, because actually Karine and I were talking about like pronouns and gender and how we just like have such limited options to even try to get out of the pronoun I, or like the idea of the self is so inscribed by contemporary English language. And so much of what I'm interested in like making a work that like really involves intimate relationship is multiplicity and kind of like a choral voice. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, the language at my disposal has all these limitations, so how can I, like, also kind of like collage it and mm-hmm. glitch it enough to create these other openings? And I really appreciate that question around etymology, and I feel like I'll just shout out my friend Justin, who's here, who was such a important interlocutor in the creation of this in terms of his background with like classics and Latin and the way we were thinking in dialogue around like where words come from, and really thinking about like how most of the processes I'm interested are like trans processes, like translation, transliteration, mm-hmm. transcription, transmutation. So I think maybe I'll stick with that as like a word that's really important to me, because it's about movement and it's about like things always being metamorphosizing, and how that's related to the way I'm kind of always making work in relation to digestive illness, and thereby like digestion as a metaphor for processing the world that around me, and transing it so that it comes out changed.
I really enjoyed how you and your dad rounded the air of the almost homophones of like Kafka and Kafka, and that being a cool transmutation that you went forward with.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I just wanted to thank both everyone for the really alive and inspiring, honest conversation and expression. Yeah, really intelligent and articulate. Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Okay, no more. Well, thanks everybody for coming, and round of applause for our audience.